Welcome to the NOLA Drinks Show. Join us as we explore the world of drink and food in New Orleans and beyond. Here's your host, Brian Diaz.
All right, everybody, welcome to the program. Brian Diaz here with you as always. Thanks, friends, for listening into the NOLA Drinks Show this week. Got a good one coming up for you here. We're going to have our featured interview recorded at the recent third annual New Orleans Bourbon Festival. Took place a little bit over a week ago. And our featured interview features, it's funny how that works, huh? Peggy No Stevens and Carla Carlton, both noted bourbon experts. Carla is a journalist, author. Peggy is a consultant, educator. Were both charter members. Peggy really was one who started it, but Carla was a charter member of Bourbon Women. It's a fine association that brings women together to enjoy bourbon, talk about it, educate, all that good stuff. Really two very, very knowledgeable bourbon people. So really fun conversation with them. If you're listening on the radio, we have an extended bit of coverage on our podcast that we usually do. Another shot with NOLA Drinks. That's kind of the norm. But usually that featured interview just continues with an extra segment. We get a little more into the weeds and that sort of thing. But we did some pretty extensive coverage of Bourbon Festival. Not quite enough to get another whole show out of it, as I was thinking might happen. So what's going to happen is I'm urging you to go get the podcast. You can go to noladrinks.com, get it on your favorite podcast platform out there. Easiest way, noladrinks.com. You'll find it there. It'll be out on Wednesday if you're listening on the radio. But yeah, we then chat a little bit further with Peggy and Carla. And then we have Tracy Napolitano and Barbara Hirsch Napolitano, a married couple. And they are the founders and organizers of Bourbon Festival. We talk with them. They reveal, before it was announced publicly at the event, who won Best in Show, which bourbon maybe will surprise you. And then Susan Riegler, who is also a fine bourbon educator and author, joins us as well. So the podcast, fairly long one this time around, friends. I would not be upset if you listen to it in two settings. Or if you just want to pour yourself a nice pour of bourbon, maybe two, maybe three, and catch the whole thing. Some really, really interesting conversation all about bourbon, friends. Programming note coming up and shows coming up in the next couple weeks here. French Quarter Festival series. Yep, the last one before French Quarter Fest happens, which is taking place April 11th through the 14th next week, friends. That's right. We're going to be chatting with the amazing musicians. They're also collaborators, good friends. Paul Sanchez, the Bard of New Orleans, and John Boutte, the very fine singer, together in one space. And they're going to tell us some interesting stories, even like stuff like some of the songs that appeared in Treme and how they wrote them. Oh, yeah, some inside scoop there. And then the following week, we're going to have a great show for you. Looking forward to this. Going to be taping it this week. Actually, going to be over at Latitude 29. Jeff Beachbum, Barry's Place. Jeff will join us. And then Jim Meehan, who is a tremendous cocktail author and historian, along with Greg Bohm, who also is a cocktail historian and owns Cocktail Kingdom. And Jim and Greg are doing an event at Latitude 29 talking about vintage cocktail books and stuff like that. So we're going to sit those three super knowledgeable cocktail historians, author types, in one space and talk about vintage cocktail books and some other cool stuff. Friends, we're going to take a short break here, and then we're going to be back. It's going to be all about bourbon. Come on back.
Goodbye, Joe. I got to go. Me oh my. I got to go. Pull a hero down to buy you. My advice is the sweetest one. Me oh my. Son of a gun, we're going to have big fun on the bayou. I said jambalaya, crawfish pie, filet gumbo.
Brian Diaz here at WGSN 990 AM in New Orleans and the podcast land, wherever you may be. Thanks for listening into the show, friends. This week,
As always, yeah, if you're listening at the top of the show, and I hope you were, we are here at New Orleans Bourbon Fest, the third installment thereof, a great event that took place about a week and a half ago or so, depending on when you're listening to this. And I am pleased to welcome my next two guests, Carla Carlton. How are you, Carla?
I'm doing well, thanks. How are you?
Yeah, absolutely. Good to see you again.
Thanks.
And Peggy No Stevens. Peggy, how are you?
Fabulous.
Excellent. Nice to see you again as well.
Thank you.
Yeah, we were talking before we started taping here. I met y'all, I guess it was a couple years ago, not 1 year ago, when you did a panel presentation at the first New Orleans Bourbon Festival, and that was really a lot of fun.
That's right.
Yeah, let's start there. Carla, why don't you tell us a little bit about your background and then how you found yourself. Why are you here at Bourbon Fest?
Why not?
That's a good answer. bourbon.
Right, there's bourbon. My background, I'm a media person, so I have written about bourbon for about 10 years, covered bourbon, wrote a bourbon book, charter member of Bourbon Women Association, which began in Louisville, Kentucky, and was thrilled to be invited to that inaugural Bourbon Fest here. I was not so thrilled when I found out my first session was at 9 a.m. after the night of drinking the night before. So the organizers here really took our feedback and have adapted. And so the earliest sessions, I think, now start at 10, which is still a little early, but but yeah, this festival is great. It's really grown, and they have some great guests and great seminars. It seems like it's such a natural fit because, you know, Kentucky and New Orleans have such a connection from way back. You know, we sent our bourbon down the Mississippi to New Orleans, and, you know, I was kind of surprised, really, that there wasn't already a bourbon festival here.
Yeah, we have a festival for everything else.
Exactly. I was actually surprised there was a weekend available for a new festival, too.
there's three every weekend.
Yeah, but, so yeah. I blog as The Bourbon Babe. I'm managing editor of Bourbon Plus magazine. And like I said, I just wrote my first book a couple years ago, Barrel Strength Bourbon. So I've been covering the industry, and it's been amazing to watch it expand over the last 10 years to the point where it is today.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Well, Peggy, what about you? You are the first master taster. Female master.
That's an important point.
That's an important point. You see, yeah, you haven't been around that long. But I'll ask you the same question as I asked Carla. How do you find yourself here at Bourbon Festival?
Well, actually, I have about 30 years of being in the industry and kind of moved up the ranks, becoming a female master bourbon taster. Later on, I ended up starting my own company, Peggy No Stevens and Associates, and was building craft distilleries, working with some of the larger players in the industry on crafting the story to tell to a visitor, conducting tasting programs and writing scripts and things of that nature. And along the way, of course, dotted in between all that, I do a lot of public speaking and tasting programs. So really my specialty, I would say, is not just judging whiskey, because I do reviews for American Whiskey Magazine and entertaining editor for Bourbon Plus Magazine, but it's also food pairings. So I think that was the catch. When I met Tracy and his beautiful wife, who's the coordinator of the festival, they simply took the time to come to Kentucky and meet with people like Carla and myself and said, gosh, you know, we'd love to have you speak. And I speak across the nation. I'm very fortunate with that. But they were so charming. And I have always been such a fan of New Orleans. And I'm a foodie at heart. So I thought, you know what, sure, we can come. We can do something. And Carla and I worked with another friend of ours, Susan Riegler. We created a seminar. I did a food pairing seminar, but we also did another seminar called Debunking the Myths of Bourbon with Women, and it was very popular and got great reviews. And so I think Carl and I have been back every year since, and that's every year it keeps getting bigger and brighter and more sessions. And so I just literally finished doing a food pairing session.
Yeah, well, let's talk about that, Peggy, since we'll get into all kinds of other stuff and as we move along here. But obviously people that listen to this show are very familiar with pairing wines with food and even pairing cocktails to a degree or spirits to a degree with food. I know chocolate goes well with bourbon. That's kind of an easy one, right? But what are some of the things you talked about in the seminar?
Well, it's really making it approachable for people, because a lot of people, I think, are intimidated because they think, oh, it's such a high proof. There's no way that it would work well with food. And we try to make it approachable. So we literally talk about dissecting the flavors that are in the whiskey and finding predominant flavors like a caramel, like a pecan, and then matching it to the flavors of food to make it balanced and complementary. Aside from the proof level, it's really just about the flavor because bourbon is so complex. And because of that complexity, it is so easy for us to recognize and identify the fruit, the sweet, the spicy, and pair it. So all we do is simplify it for the consumer and for the people who attend the conference. And once they experience it literally in a flavored way, tasting and comparing, they fall in love with it. And they think, gosh, this is so simple. You've made it so simple. So we just try to focus on breaking down the flavors and then matching, you know, abundant flavors with food flavors that are similar.
Right. Got it. And I think it's also interesting too, right, because you can sort of make complementary bridges between the beverage, and then you can do counterpoint.
And that's one that's great because I actually call one of mine counterbalance.
Okay, great.
You know, almost in the wine world, you'd compare it to drinking a Riesling wine with a Cajun pecan.
Right.
In the whiskey world, we try to find a really heavy caramel vanilla sweet note with a spicy, whether it's Asian or a balsamic vinegar or you know anything that has a little spike to it.
It'll cut through
and,
it.
Yes, and that has the same effect.
Yeah, very interesting. And we could talk about that for forever.
That's
too.
A whole show. Yeah, that's a whole other show.
We'll do that. We'll do that. We'll do a focused one when we get to that point.
Okay.
We'll, next time you're in town, Peggy, we'll
great.
Do that. Well, right. Carla, you just did a session too.
Yes, I did a session called Just Add Water. You know, I think it's interesting with the increasing popularity of bourbon. We've seen an increase in bourbon snobbery, unfortunately. I think there are a lot of people who think, oh my gosh, you can't add water to bourbon. You can't add ice to bourbon. That's, you know, and it's ridiculous. Obviously, you should drink bourbon how you want to drink bourbon. But what's interesting is that adding water to bourbon often changes the taste profile of bourbon. So what we did in this seminar is we tasted four bourbons neat, and then we added water. And then we added ice, and we looked at how the taste profiles changed. And I hauled some Louisville tap water down to New Orleans. Louisville Water Company is the first and only utility to trademark its tap water. It's called Louisville Pure Tap. And so I brought some water down with me, and we used that to add to the bourbon. And what we found is that in some cases, you know, adding water enhances the bourbon. It brings out more spice notes or more fruit notes. In some cases, adding ice then tamps those down or, enhances those. It's just really interesting. And I encourage people to try this, you know, in the session to try this at home with other brands. At every session that I've done, people come away saying, oh, I always drank this neat, but now I'm going to add ice. Or I always put ice in my bourbon, but now I'm going to try it neat. So, you know, it's just a kind of a fun, interactive way to look at, you know, different ways of approaching bourbon. And there's actually a scientific reason for why water enhances whiskey. There's a compound in whiskey called guaiacol, and it tends to sink to the bottom. So when you add water, it brings it to the top, and it helps you taste some more of those smoky and, you know, I guess savory flavors.
Kind of like some of the baking spice notes. And
yes,
that sort of
yeah, like and it brings those up. So there is a scientific reason for that, and it's just I think it's a really fun way to play with your bourbon and not be so serious about it.
Mm-hmm. Do you mind if I just say from a personal note, because I'm a Louisville, Kentucky girl, and we've been so proud of our water for so long, and my father actually worked for the Louisville Water Company for 30 years.
I did not know that.
Oh, okay.
Yes, and that's why I just thought you'd find that entertaining,
yes,
because they had connoisseurs in the early days actually do water comparisons, even in France. And the water, hands down, was judged across the nation as the best.
Mm-hmm.
So I just thought, you know, this isn't a new thing that our water's great.
Right.
So we celebrate it now, and I'm thrilled with that.
That's really cool.
That's why I love Carla's seminar.
Well, they actually have, you know, they have, just as bourbons have master distillers, the water company has, you know, master tasters, and they're looking for similar things, but where the master taster for bourbon is looking for, a rainbow of flavors, the master taster for water is looking for no flavor. You know, they're looking for, purity, and I just think that's really fascinating. So it was a way to, you know, to explore that and look at, not being quite so stuffy about about bourbon, and you know, just another way to approach it and have fun with it.
I appreciate you saying that because I think it's so important to remind people to experience and enjoy as they choose.
Right.
Right. The quickest way to turn people off is by being a snob.
Absolutely. And, you know, even our, you know, the master distillers in Kentucky would tell you, you know, drink it the way you want to, just drink it. You know? Right, they're right. They're not, you know.
We even joke about, you know, if you want to drink it with tomato juice, be our guest. If you're, right. You know, if that's how you
just
enjoy
it.
Because I do think that that's been a huge reason that the bourbon industry has just taken off and skyrocketed, because we taught people different cocktails to enjoy it. Mm-hmm. Or if you just want to put it on the rocks and enjoy it that way,
right.
It's simply your choice.
Mm-hmm. Right. And I thank you for saying that, because mm-hmm. it's very important. Let me ask you this question, you guys, because, and we'll take a break here in about 3-4 minutes, but you mentioned sort of snobbery in the industry, and I don't want to flog this one too much, but there's like become a real fanboy kind of thing that goes on, and very specifically I'll ask you because I'm part of some of these online forums and things, and there has to be this constant policing of etiquette in these conversation groups because people just bash people, and some people I've noticed, somebody new saying, I'm looking for help and I'm looking for guidance, and then people just take them apart. Why did you buy that bottle? That's stupid, or you paid too much money, mm-hmm. and these things. And as we've seen the industry grow, I think that's probably attracted some of that. Is that fair to say? And how do we kind of deal with it?
I think
it's kind of a weird question.
Right. No, I think that's fair. I've seen that too on some Facebook forums and different forums. And I think that's, you know, it's just it's the complete opposite to bourbon. I mean, bourbon is about hospitality. Bourbon is about enjoying a drink with friends, and it's a welcoming thing. It's not, you know, I think that's terrible, because I think, you know, when people are asking questions, they really want to learn, and that's what Bourbon Women is about. You know, it's providing an opportunity, a safe space, if you will, where people can ask their questions and have them answered. You know, there's no dumb questions. But right. I do think there are some snobs, and often they're wrong, I might add.
Well, that's what I was going to add, because I really think there's never been a time in the last 30 years that I've been in the industry that the consumer is so wildly educated.
Mm-hmm.
And right. they know, they don't want, because I do distilleries and tours, and they don't want to just know that there's corn in the whiskey. They want to go out to the crop, and they want to mm-hmm. peel the corn back, and they want to understand the cellulose of the corn. They're very finite. And so I think this is part of we're educating so much that people tend to become experts in their own mind. And so Carl is correct. Mm-hmm. I have found, and I know she has too, that some of the tastings that we do, the person that speaks up the most, that acts like they know the most, usually is incorrect on a few things.
Oh, yeah. I did a tasting once where it was for a charitable organization, and one of the gentlemen, you know, I said, there's no minimum aging for bourbon. And there isn't. There's a minimum aging for straight bourbon, 2 years. And he just was, no, you know, it's 2 years. And I said, well, no, it isn't. You know, and I didn't really want to, you know, take the guy apart. It was a mm-hmm. charitable, you know. Mm-hmm. So later he came up and he said, well, I Googled that and you're right. And I was like, well, thank you very much. That's why I'm here speaking, you know.
Right, right.
But yeah.
Now
I mean,
the public vlogging will commence.
Exactly. But, you know, it's you know, and even I've had even, you know, not so much anymore, but even bartenders argue that you can only make bourbon in Kentucky. And nope, that's not right either. You can make it in the United States. But that's, you know, and people are becoming more educated about that one.
And we love that,
yeah.
That people are becoming more educated, because we want you to enjoy the product and understand the complexity of it. But Carl is correct in the mm-hmm. hospitality side, and also just the relaxation side of bourbon. You know,
right.
Just relax and enjoy it.
Yeah.
You know, I think that sometimes when we even do tastings, in fact, the mm-hmm. event that we did at the Bourbon Festival,
mm-hmm.
It was about the enjoyment of the product and not how much you knew.
Right.
Right.
It's supposed to be fun.
It's supposed to be fun.
It's supposed to be fun.
We have a good time.
We have a good time.
Yeah.
Let's do this. Let's take a little break and we'll come back and talk a little bit more.
Right.
All right. Friends, we're chatting with Carl Carlton and Peggy Noe Stevens. We'll take a little break here on the Noel Drink Show. Come on back.
Every afternoon when I wake up,
right, Everybody, welcome back to the show. Brian D. is here. Brian D. I can't even say my own name. I haven't had that much bourbon yet.
He's been drinking. Don't let him laugh. Don't let him laugh.
What's the proof on this?
118.
118.
Yeah, 118.
That'll do it. I'm going to continually go downhill as the broadcast here continues, apparently. But we're chatting with Peggy No Stevens and Carla Carlton. And you both were involved in, if I'm not mistaken, Peggy, you were kind of the original founder of Bourbon Women Association, and you were one of the charter members and board members, Carla, right?
That's right.
And we were talking during the break and kind of segueing out of what we spoke about, changing the tone of and timbre of the industry. Maybe I'll put it that way. And I think, Peggy, as you said, this is very much why you wanted to start the organization.
It was. Looking back, there was a time that I lived in Chicago, and I was in the hotel business at the time. And we go out on a Friday night, and I was from Kentucky, and I would go out with the sales team, and we would go to the bar, and, you know, some of the women were ordering wine spritzers because that was in vogue at the time. And I would say, give me a bourbon on the rocks, please. And all the men at the bar would turn their head, whip their head around, and go, what did she just order? What was that drink she just had? And it was so normal to me growing up in Kentucky. I mean, it was just part of the fabric of my life, basically. So fast forward, when I would conduct tastings, being a master taster, and I would have a few female in the audience, they would never ask questions. And so the men weren't a bit shy, and they really enjoyed the seminar. And later, the women would come up after the seminar was over, and they would say what they wanted to say, very intelligent questions. Mm-hmm. And so it dawned on me that we weren't creating a conversation or a platform, that maybe women weren't, you know, comfortable in such a bold atmosphere. And so we created the Bourbon Women Association for education purposes, for sure. And we wanted to make a difference in the industry. So we're a 501c6, and we help with legislation, lobbying, anything the industry asks us to do. But at the same time, this platform has grown into literally thousands of women across the United States. We're in 7 cities formally as branches. We have an annual Sipposium conference in Louisville, Kentucky. An entire weekend of education, excursions, behind the scenes. And you would be amazed at the camaraderie. And Carla can speak to that too, because she's witnessed this firsthand. The camaraderie of the women who enjoy this, and they are educated. We are educating them, and they have it's more conversational now for them. So that is truly what we want it to do, is help the industry speak to them, because we're the other half of the population.
Right. Do we know roughly these days the percent of consumption, men versus women, in the world of bourbon?
In totality, no.
Okay.
In totality.
Because I know in certain spirit categories, like tequila, for example, that it's a sizable number of, I think it's even more than half, are represented by women, mm-hmm, in that demographic, or excuse me, that part of the segment. Go ahead.
Well, truly, I was just going to say, truly, in the industry, they're just starting to tap into, many companies are starting to tap into that market of female. Mm-hmm. So they're doing more research. Bourbon Women Association, we've actually done some of our own research just to debunk the myths, as we say, because part of what Carla and another friend of ours, Susan Riegler, and myself have done, we found that women actually gravitate to the spicier, more robust, and higher-proofed bourbons, because I think the perception out there is that you have to pinkify a whiskey in order for a woman to like it, and it's not true.
Right. Carla, as you've covered the industry for several years now and seen, what are some of the changes that you're seeing, especially seeing more women, I think really from top to bottom in the industry, right? Mm-hmm. Not just on the consumer side, but everywhere.
Right. Yeah, when I first started writing about bourbon, it was very unusual, to be a bourbon journalist, which it was a great niche for me. But, you know, even as a consumer, but I remember in particular, one of the first whiskey fests that I attended in Chicago. Whiskey Fest is another festival where there are, 300 kinds of whiskeys. And there's a VIP hour where you can pay extra and get in, and you get your tasting glass. And so I paid extra. I was there with my tasting glass. I had my credentials. I was, legit. And I had tasted all the bourbons that were there, so I thought I'd branch out. I'm not a big Scotch drinker. Somebody had told me that Redbreast, an Irish whiskey, was a good whiskey to try. So I thought, okay, I'll try that. I walk up to the booth. There's a young man and an older man sitting there. And I said, I'd like to try the Redbreast. The young man says, do you want the 12-year, the 15-year, or the cask strength? And, of course, cask strength is, directly out of the barrel. And I said, well, I don't know. What would you recommend? The old man, leaps into action. He says, well, if you're just starting out, I'd recommend the 12-year, and then the 15-year, and then maybe the cask strength. So I waited for a beat, and then I you know, drew on the accent of my native people. And I said, well, if it makes a difference, I'm from Kentucky, and I like a high-proof bourbon. And they paused for a moment, and he said, in that case, you may proceed directly to the cask strength. So I did, you know, and it was fine. But, you know, I love that story because that is the perception, you know, that we need an umbrella in our drink or something. And I do tend to like the spicier, more robust, bourbons. But I think it's gotten better, certainly in Kentucky. And I think it's getting better elsewhere. But, you know, Peggy's right. I think, you know, when I went to my very first inaugural Bourbon Women event, I didn't know many of the women who were there. But I left feeling like I had all these friends because everyone who was there was very similar to me. I think you did psychographic research.
I did psychographic research, yes.
Can you expand on that?
Mm-hmm. Sure. Of course, women are a demographic, right, statistically speaking. But when you look at the psychographics of the pool of women, it did not matter our age. Mm-hmm. 21, of course, that we like to say LDA, legal drinking age, to right. D&D, damn near dead. You know? But we looked across all ages, and what all the women had strategic themes. That's the mm-hmm. psychographics. They were curious, highly educated. They loved soft adventure. They were foodies. They loved to travel. They just shared so many common right. interests that was the cohesiveness. Mm-hmm. It wasn't their age. Yes, it was female, but mm-hmm. it was more than that.
And very independent.
Very
outspoken.
Independent. Yeah. A lot mm-hmm. of bravado.
Right.
And willing to take on risks and challenges. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it was fascinating, actually. And so we, you know, just like the New Orleans Bourbon Festival, we brought 70 women this year from the Bourbon mm-hmm. Women Association through a VIP ticket that they had. And they made the journey. They're traveling. They're having a ball. You know, and we see that camaraderie of them traveling together now.
Mm-hmm. That's fantastic. Now, are you finding that more people are becoming involved with the organization that maybe don't fit that archetype of being maybe as affluent, as independent? Do you think it's starting to kind of trickle into other parts of the demographic? And I hate to use that term, but are you finding people maybe that are a little shyer or maybe, you know, a little less adventurous are starting to find this as a vector into something else?
I think that we define bravado in a lot of different ways. You don't have to be an extrovert to have bravado at the same time, you know, and to be courageous. And so, you know, these women come in all shapes and sizes mm-hmm. as far as their personalities, but there is a common thread of confidence in what they drink and what they like.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And if the industry would just listen, I think, to hearing them say, here's the way I drink it, here's the way I like my bourbon, I think they would own the market.
Mm-hmm.
Makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
Let's see where we are. Well, we got about a minute left. We're going to take a break. Carla, do me a favor. Tell me a little bit about how you feel how the industry has changed. We kind of talked a little bit more about consumer and enjoyment. Have mm-hmm. you seen more change as far as people holding higher positions within the companies and within the industry side?
Yes, I think women have always held positions in the industry. They haven't been very publicized. Certainly, there are more women becoming master distillers, which, you know, is great. I think also the industry really just hasn't marketed at all to women, which has been, you know, a big gap, you know, and they've been kind of clumsy in their marketing strategies. So one thing Bourbon Women has tried to do is provide information, you know, as Peggy said, about here's a good way to market to us. You know, this is what we're looking for. But I do think the industry is definitely taking notice. You know, we're half the population. So why would you not want to market to us? Why would you not want to, you know, promote women?
It's a reasonable business decision.
Yeah, it seems logical to me. But there definitely are women who are coming up, you know, through the ranks and becoming leaders, you know, not just master distillers, but, you know, vice presidents of production. There are definitely a lot more women, and I think the industry is making, you know, more, putting more of a spotlight on those women.
Excellent. Can we take a break?
Sure.
Okay, great, friends. We're going to take a little break here on the NOLA Drink Show. Come on back.
Mighty cool to find you on a mighty broad day. New Orleans.
and you can understand just what I mean. Now all through the week it's quiet as a mouse, but on Saturday night they go from house to house. You don't have to pay the usual.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the show. Brian Diaz here with WGSO 990 AM in New Orleans and in podcast land wherever you may be. Thanks for listening into the show this week. And yeah, I'm chatting with Peggy Noe Stevens and Carla Carlton. And interesting conversation, you two, during the break. We were talking about sort of all kinds of things, but the changing landscape of the industry, people kind of getting really into the collecting thing, and maybe we'll even, I'll use, you didn't say this, I will, the hoarding thing. But the key point, and Peggy, I'll throw this to you first. We were talking about this before. The whole idea is to enjoy this stuff, right?
Right.
I mean, and some of the perspective you were sharing about, you know, people, I wouldn't put words in your mouth. It's about enjoying it. It's about drinking it, isn't it?
That's right. It's absolutely. And, you know, again, I think that people would be surprised if they come to my home and see how many commemorative special bottles I have, because there aren't many, because I drink them. We like to enjoy them.
Right, right.
You know, but I was saying that I think that a specialty bottle is in the eye of the consumer, just like a piece of art. Some people consider a great piece of art worthy of a high price, and some people would pass that same piece of artwork and think, oh gosh, I would never buy that and put that on my wall. So it's really a conundrum in a way, because it's limited quantity sometimes, and retailers, distributors are trying to get their hands on it, and it becomes difficult sometimes to be able to satisfy the consumer because it's not readily available.
Do we think, because we're talking about the allocation game and some of these things, how much of that is insidious in this process of people realizing that's really going to, that drives a lot of brand recognition and drives a lot of kind of the frenzy that goes on with this? I think people want to put out small supply stuff, limited quantity stuff, right?
But I think it's in any industry.
Yeah, for sure.
Let's take concerts, mm-hmm. and concert tickets or movie tickets or something that who's first.
Right.
Who's first to get the tickets? You know, how good are the tickets? I think it's in any industry. It's a matter of balancing it, I think.
I think that's a fair point, because we've kind of pushed in this really interesting direction of people selling certain bottles for $5,000.
Right.
And yeah. Well, let me ask you this. How do we see the overall – this is just a general question about the industry itself. What in the past few years have you seen change in the industry? I mean, a lot more people drinking bourbon, right?
Right. Well, I think, you know, it's – definitely a rising tide, you know, lifts all boats. I think we've seen a lot more craft distillers, especially in Kentucky. In fact, we're a little bit behind the curve on that. We've gone from, I guess when I started writing about bourbon a decade ago, we had 8 distilleries. Now we have 68 distilleries.
Wow. Yeah.
And we're still like 11th in the country in terms of number of distilleries. Now we still make 90% of the world's supply of bourbon because we have the big guys. But you're seeing just, you know, lots of craft distillers in every state in the union.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think it'll be interesting to see how many of those are still in operation in 5 years.
Before being swallowed up by the mothership.
Yes. Or just, or just going out of business. I mean, it's a tremendously expensive operation, you know, up front. And a lot of people can't afford to let things age, you know, 2 to 4 years, which
right.
is kind of the sweet spot. So you've seen some craft distillers releasing things, you know, probably too early, and having to charge a lot for them. So that, I think, will work itself out. But, you know, go ahead.
Did you find that the industry overall, so we'll use, you know, the big guys that were out there, generally welcoming to craft distillers, generally threatened by craft distillers, or is everybody in between? We're not going to name names.
Yeah, I think in Kentucky they've been pretty welcoming. I mean,
well, it's interesting you say that, because I work with a lot of craft mm-hmm. distilleries, and I believe there was a 20% increase in craft distilleries from 2017 to 2018. So
wow.
it's still climbing. And to Carla's point, it's a very expensive sport to be in.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and you have to be patient in order to get the revenue. But I know that when the craft movement, and I call it a movement, first started, you know, maybe 10, 12 years ago, and you know, associations were formed like the American Distilling Institute, et cetera. It was all about teaching these craft people how to make whiskey. And I think the big boys, if you will, in the industry never even thought twice about it, because they thought they could never touch our infrastructure.
Mm.
You know, it would never put a dent in our sales because they'll never be as good as we are. So fast forward to today, and I think our big boys, if you will, are now doing acquisitions of
mm-hmm.
these craft. I think you're going to see more and more acquisitions.
Right.
I think you're going to see more and more partnerships where some of the craft distilleries are selling juice. mm-hmm. And vice versa. It goes both ways. Mm-hmm. So it's a very interesting time. And I think we're going to see a lot shake out in the next 5 years of who made it, who was acquired, and who refuses to sell. Because I do know some craft distillers who refuse to sell.
And do you think is there a good hope for them to survive? I mean, are we going to see some of these craft folks survive?
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I think so. But I think you're also going to see a lot of distilling equipment on eBay in 5 years from now. You know,
and I agree with that. Yeah, I agree with that.
But yeah, it is interesting because a lot of the craft guys in Kentucky have reached a level where they are being acquired by larger companies, not just bourbon distillers, but it's a way for companies that don't have brown spirits to get into that game.
Right.
And it's not just an influx of money for craft distillers, but also that marketing infrastructure. You know, a lot of craft guys, they're the distiller, they're the tour guide, they're the groundskeeper, so mm-hmm. it frees them up to have more time to spend on the distilling part of that. So that's happening a lot right now.
I was just going to mm-hmm. add that the thing that they don't realize, the craft distilling industry sometimes, is that they all come from such different backgrounds.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, maybe they might have a chemistry degree or engineering, which is certainly going to help them, or scientific background, but some are psychiatrists, some are musicians, some are entrepreneurs who made it big in another industry like the tech business, and now mm-hmm. they're making whiskey. And when you start a craft distillery, you're not just in the whiskey making business. You're in the sales business, the distribution business, the hospitality business,
right.
the tasting room business, the food and beverage
business, the merchandise business,
the merchandising business, yeah. the yeah. retail business. And that's the eye-opener, I think, mm-hmm. for a lot of craft distillers.
Do you think there's a lot of naivety still where people are coming in, maybe, you're a successful doctor and then
yes,
you want
to. Yes, but
in like
an
whiskey.
Endearing way.
Okay.
I think, and the reason why I say that, it's the American dream.
Mm-hmm.
I think they follow the American dream of making it big in the industry. And I also see people who have made it big in their own right, in their own industry, who think it's like a playground.
Mm-hmm.
And it's fun. It's going to be fun, just like when people bought vineyards and wineries. So I see both ends of the spectrum, where families have put in all their money, mm-hmm. To support this craft distillery. And then I see very wealthy people who, it's a drop in the bucket, it's just an investment.
Yeah,
right.
and just sort of a side gig, yeah.
You also see in Louisville, we have the Distilled Spirits Epicenter, which grew up, that's a place where distillers can come and learn their craft. And maybe, or they can come and decide, no, I don't want to do this, it's too much work. But that kind of grew up, Vendome is a company that builds stills. It's been in Louisville for over 100 years, and I know I did an interview with them recently, and they said, we've been doing these for 100 years, and suddenly in the past couple of years, everybody wants to interview us. We don't know what's going on, but they would build these stills for some of these craft guys, and then they were calling up and saying, okay, we have it. What do we do? How do we use this thing? And they're like, well, we're not in the business of, we don't have time to teach you how to distill. So the Distilled Spirits Epicenter grew up as an education component.
Okay.
It's a member of the Kentucky Distillers Association, and they hold classes, year round. And a lot of people, once they go through this distiller's course, they decide against it. It's just, this is not for me. It's too much of an expense.
Mm-hmm.
But there is a big learning curve, and it's a lot of upfront money before you ever see
Absolutely.
A profit at all.
And I think what the Epicenter has done mm-hmm. so well is they're not just teaching the whiskey making. I myself teach a retail tasting room class.
Peggy, can you do me a favor?
Yeah.
Can you hold that thought?
Oh, sure.
I got to close up. And let's when we do the podcast, I think let's continue
sure.
with the conversation.
Mm-hmm.
Carla, very quickly tell people where they can find you online and all that good
stuff. I'm at thebourbonbabe.com, and I'm at Carla Carlton on Twitter, and at Carla Carlton on Instagram.
Okay, great. And Peggy, you
just
and
look
for Bourbon
Peggy
Women.
PeggyNoStevens.com, and if they're interested in Bourbon Women, bourbonwomen.org.
Excellent. Thank you. And you two are going to stick around for another shot with Nola Drinks.
Yes,
we'll continue
yes,
the conversation.
Absolutely.
So,
yes.
Friends, if you're listening on the radio, go get the podcast, because we're going to keep chatting with Peggy and Carla. So if you're listening on the radio, I thank you very much for that. Please remember to be kind to one another. Use your turn signal. And until then, cheers, y'all.
said, my child, what are you doing in a place like this? I said, I called your name, but no one came. Now I see you become just like the company you keep. And he said, all these saints and all these sinners will try.
Everybody, thanks for sticking around for another Shot with Noel Drinks. Brian Diaz here with you as always. Hope you enjoy our ongoing conversation here with Peggy No Stevens and Carla Carlton. A lot of fun talking to them, sipping on some bourbon. We're going to bounce back over to Bourbon Fest, which, as I noted at the top of the show, took place a little bit over a week ago. As you're hearing this on the radio or podcast, about a week and a half ago, something along those lines. And we're going to keep chatting with them. Then our extended coverage picks up and we're going to chat with Barbara Hirsch Napolitano and Tracy Napolitano, the organizers of Bourbon Festival here in New Orleans, and then Susan Riegler, author and educator in the world of bourbon, will join us as well. So pretty extensive stuff going on here, pretty long show, but we wanted to bring you so much stuff going on at Bourbon Fest. That's what we wanted to bring you, a lot of Bourbon Fest and a lot of bourbon and a lot of people talking about it, because that's what we do, that type of thing here on the NOLA Drink Show, friends. Going to be right back with Peggy and Carla. Here we go. Yep, another Shot with Noel Drinks. Brian Diaz here with you. Thanks for listening. And we are at New Orleans Bourbon Fest, the third annual. And we are chatting with Peggy No Stevens and Carla Carlton. And as we were talking about, this is the F-bomb time. So I know you both have been waiting to...
We've been saving them up.
We've been saving them up. We're sipping on bourbon. I can just, you know, you're kind of, I can see that they're ready to drop. Well, let's start here because I would be remiss. Our good friend Tracy Napolitano, who is the Bourbon Fest organizer, I said, can we have something to taste? Because I know I think I sound better after I've been drinking bourbon, which is totally not true. What do you think of this one? What can you tell us what we're tasting here and tell me what y'all think about it?
Yeah, this is the apparently the 2019 New Orleans Bourbon Fest Barrel Bourbon Single Barrel Pick Cask Strength. I think it's pretty good. It's got a lot of
118 proof.
118 proof.
Which I think on the nose, it's for 118 proof,
very mild.
Yeah. That's what Carla, we were talking about how nutty.
Peggy, I think when you said something about it having a sort of a Frangelica note, I think that was really spot on because it's got that kind of creamy, nutty, slightly
creamy,
sweet
nutty.
Thing going on there.
That's mostly what I get from that. You know, not a lot of fruit, but a lot of...
It's a beautiful color, which shows its barrel quality. But I also get this overture of orange, orange spice, though. A little bit of orange spice.
And it's 14 years old.
Okay. Yeah, I find it very nice. And tell me, when you're approaching something that is high proof like this, I think a lot of people kind of shy away from it. They go, oh, that's got a lot of alcohol, and I'm used to drinking maybe the 90 kind of proof stuff. And I continually am surprised, Peggy, just very much as what you said, that some of these ones that are, you know, up pushing 120 can be very, very approachable when they're well-balanced, right? And how do we – what do we look for in those? Because some of them burn. Some of them are – don't. And this one was very nice. I mean, how do you approach that when you're tasting stuff?
Well, because I review whiskeys, and it really comes through in the finish, you know, the alcohol. After you've tasted it, and I use the term warm, and then I use the term burn. And there's a big difference. When I have a real mouthfeel of warmth, it's in a good proof way. When it's more of a burn... in the back of your throat, then it might need to come down a few notches on the proof level. But I do teach a trick, actually, that's very helpful when people take a sip.
Which Peggy is doing now. I'm giving play-by-play. Go on.
And then blow out after they swallow. Mm-hmm. It'll break down the alcohol, and you can really taste the quality of the whiskey. If proof... is one of those things that's a deterrent to your taste buds. Some people love it. And I do think it's a debate in our industry, really, if proof makes a difference of flavor. Okay. I think it does. I definitely think it does. And that's how you tell how well crafted it is when it's a high proof and you really, you know, it's a warmth.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And so is it something where maybe when the proof is a little higher, it's harder to maybe fake your way through it a little bit from the quality of it? Maybe, and then just throwing this out there, I don't know at all. But
it can be easier to fake your way through it with a high proof sometimes because, you know, if it's very high alcohol, you know, it can cover some flaws sometimes. But I think this is very well balanced.
It's really easy for 118 proof.
Yeah, that's the part that's kind of scary, isn't it?
Yeah, it's going to go down very nice.
And we tend to call that Kentucky. We call that warmth the Kentucky hug because it kind of hugs you, you know. So, yeah.
Perfect.
This is a nice Kentucky hug.
Well, let me ask you this question. Listeners of the show know we just had Agave Week here, so we were talking. We did a show last week on mezcal. Mm-hmm. One of my favorite things. And in one of the seminars, since we were talking about seminars earlier, I was moderating some panels. And there's always that guy, right? And it's almost always a guy in the panel. And I said, if you want to ask questions, please ask pointed questions what we're talking about. And then there's Q&A time at the end that your general questions can be asked. And this particular guy was asking, and I'll be very brief, but if agave can grow anywhere, and there's such a shortage of mezcal, then people can go listen to the show from a couple weeks ago. Why don't we just grow agave here in Louisiana and solve the problem? Because we can bring technology to the table, and we can bring modern ag to the table, and we can just sort of solve anything. And part of the argument, of course, is that if you take the agave out of that part of Mexico, you no longer have mezcal. Mm-hmm. There's a sense of place, and a terroir is defined in part by culture and the human component of it as well. Bourbon is obviously something like that, I think, and if you'd maybe share your thoughts on that, because I think there are... In the spirits world, there are certain things that have a sense of place, and you can't take it somewhere else. Like, Carla, to your point, certainly you can make what's called bourbon anywhere in America, but we're talking about the water in Kentucky and these things, that there is a sense of place to some of these distillates that would not be the same without the location and the people.
Right. Well, I think, you know, we certainly have more history with bourbon than anywhere else. I mean, we have, you know, over 200 years. We've been making bourbon since before we were a state or a commonwealth. And I think that's what's really neat about the bourbon tourism experience, for example. You know, if you want to go tour wine, you can go to Napa or Sonoma. You could also go to France. You could go to, you know, any other wine producing. But if you really want to experience the bourbon experience, you really have to come to Kentucky because it really is the birthplace of bourbon. At least that's my take on it. The history and the culture, it's really just, you know, if it really flows through our entire, you know, our entire history.
We've had 200 years of perfecting, you know, bourbon, and it was really just about cultural essence. Kentucky had everything naturally conducive to making great whiskey. You know, you mentioned the water, great limestone water. We had rich soil for corn. We had extreme temperatures of hot and cold, which was great for cycling whiskey and the barrels in and out, right? So all of these things kind of come together in abundance, and that's why we had everything conducive. And so over time, we were known, regionality-wise, you know, for our bourbon pedigree, as I call it. Now, I do believe in it, just like champagne can only be called champagne in one area, but then there's sparkling wine.
Right.
You know, there is an essence to the cultural essence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you. I think that's really important. And something that I've been stressing a lot is that there is that sense of place. And when we talk about, too, like with Mezcal in particular, you know, you have these generational families, and it's the same in bourbon, right, that have been making the product, and people are all very well connected to each other. That really matters in this as well. And it's not saying that there's not room for new people and all this and stuff, but if you take that away from, I'm just going to use Mezcal as the example, that if you take that away, you're ruining a local economy, you're ruining a local tradition, and you're ruining the product. And I mean, sure, we can grow agave somewhere and make a distillate out of it. We just can't call it Mezcal, I think.
Well, and we would never say you can't make bourbon anywhere else in the United States.
Sure.
It's just different.
It is different. Yeah. Well, and since we're on the subject, and a mutual friend of ours, Lisa Wicker from Widow Jane, and I, because they chose to, they're calling theirs bourbon. And I think from a marketing standpoint, it's a pretty smart choice to use the term bourbon, right, these days?
Mm-hmm.
I think some people have kind of, like, outside of Kentucky, have stayed away, kind of shied away from using the term for various reasons, right? But, I mean, what do you think of that?
Bourbon is in its boom. Mm-hmm. And I think that... many people want to ride the wave of that. I will say there's an incredible increase in rye whiskey as well that I'm seeing as a trend.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to see more malted whiskeys coming. You know, I see that when I review whiskeys all the time, you know, what's coming in. and what's getting to be a broader audience, especially when I judge whiskeys. And so malted whiskeys coming down the pike as well.
Interesting. Yeah.
Now, I will say there are also things that are calling themselves bourbon that are not bourbon.
Okay.
And I think that, you know, as we've said before, the consumer is so much more educated, at this point than ever. And people see through that. So if you're going to call yourself bourbon, you better be following the rules of bourbon, you know. If you're a whiskey, that's fine. I mean, I think people are pretty accepting of this stuff as long as you're transparent. You know, if you're sourcing whiskey, that's fine.
You just have to tell the truth.
Yeah, just tell the truth. Don't say it's your, Uncle Grandpa's recipe if that's not the truth, you know.
You know what's so lovely, too, is I can't tell you how many craft distilleries across the U.S. that I've either interviewed or I've worked on, and how many actually come to Kentucky to learn the trade.
Mm-hmm.
That they're very respectful about it. And the feedback that I receive from these craft distillers outside of Kentucky is how welcoming our distillers were in teaching them and wanting them to do well.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, back to that camaraderie of the industry, I applaud that. I really applaud that. But I love that people have enough respect to come and see how it's done.
Right.
That's important. And as you said, go ahead, Carla, please.
I was just going to say, I recently visited Treaty Oak Distilling, which is outside Austin. And, you know, they also came to Kentucky, and I think they came to the Distilled Spirits Institute, Epicenter. But they want to make, Texas bourbon, which is fine because their climate is different, So, I mean, that makes sense. And, they're respecting the tradition, but they want to start their own tradition. And I think that's great. You know, their stuff is good. It's not, does it taste like Kentucky bourbon? No, but it's, it's good. And they're embracing their own, starting their own tradition.
Their own sense of place,
yeah.
Right?
Right.
I think that's a great point. And they make some nice stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, let's do this. Can you tell people again where it is the bourbon. It's the 180.
Usually have not, some more.
You're a lightweight. Come on.
Goodness. You don't stumble this badly. That's my wife. She's sitting right here. Do I do? Anyway, tell people where they can find you all online again.
Yes, I'm at thebourbonbabe.com and at Carla Carlton on Twitter and Instagram.
And I'm PeggyNoStevens.com for my website and PeggyNoStevens on Instagram, Twitter, etc. And bourbonwomen.org.
Yes.
Bourbonwomen.org.
If you are interested
That's
in
right.
learning more
and
about our association.
Join us.
Yes, we'd love to have you.
Awesome. You too, Carla. Peggy, thank you so much for making some
thank
time.
Thank you. It's been great.
Chatting with you. Thank you.
All right, friends, real short musical interlude, brief break, and then we're going to be back chatting with Tracy and Barbara, organizers of the Bourbon Festival.
Yep, everybody, welcome to our extended coverage here of New Orleans Bourbon Festival, friends. Yep, the third annual installment thereof. Great event, and I'm pleased to be joined as we kick off this portion of our coverage by the organizers and founders of said Bourbon Fest, Tracy Napolitano. How you doing, buddy?
I'm doing good.
This is you've been on with me 3-4 times now, I think, right?
Yeah, pretty much.
Right around there. And then also, but first-time guests, Barbara Hirsch Napolitano.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely, and you guys are a married unit.
Yes.
Well, a unit's a strong word, huh? We were talking about, certain political viewpoints
unit.
And other things
yeah.
are a little different. So, yeah. Unit's good, but could imply maybe other things, too.
Yeah.
And Barbara, you're also, as we were just talking about before we got on, I'm going to call you the quartermaster
okay.
of New Orleans Bourbon Festival, because just now you're pulling in sushi-grade tuna, you're getting ice trucks, you're getting oysters from Felix's, you're making it all happen.
Well, that's I have a lot of jobs. I'm also apparently NOBF IT department.
Congratulations.
I found
awesome.
That out today as well.
Being a Mac user, we had some issues with the PCs, and I had a call in the IT department over here to fix them.
Exactly.
Did you get it done?
Absolutely.
Oh, look at see. I mean,
yeah.
So, Tracy, what is your role in all this then? We have Barbara here. I'm trying to figure out what the hell it is that you actually do.
Well, he's the face.
Oh, he's the. Okay, got it.
The card says executive director, but they all say I'm the face, and I don't know why they picked this face.
Well, he does have a face for radio.
There you go.
Yeah, exactly.
And as I like to say, and I have a voice for print.
That's awesome.
Well, I want to tell you guys right out of the gate here, this is the third annual version of the festival. You guys do a fantastic job, I think. Okay. It's one of my favorite festivals. And we were talking about last night at the first of two grand tastings. It's just so pleasant. I mean, it's you guys don't oversell tickets. It's comfortable. It's well presented. And it's just you guys do a fantastic job. So congratulations on another good year.
Thank you so very much.
Absolutely. My pleasure. And thank you for including me in some of this. So it's been wonderful. How are you guys feeling? I mean, we're kind of at the midway point of the weekend portion of
yeah,
things.
Yeah. I'm settled down now because I've generally I'm the one of the whole group of us is just always a nervous wreck that something's going to go wrong.
Can I tell the story?
You can tell the story.
So he's so bad every year. I mean, he's really bad every year. So this year, when he was panicking so. He was driving us all crazy. So we were setting up our passwords and stuff for our Wi-Fi at the CAC, and we named it Chicken Little. And used
right, I almost snarfed my bourbon. Thank you.
And used Napolitano as the password. And we knew we would all remember it at that point. Well,
they didn't really tell me about this, and I was outside trying to We have the gobo lights outside in the front when you come in.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was affecting the scanning on the reader.
Oh, really? Okay.
So I went out there. So we figured reset would make it work. So I had to ask for the password, and they're like, "It's a Chicken Little Napolitano." I'm like, "Really?" I mean, I knew exactly who they were talking about.
That was a great choice of password.
Thank you so much. Yeah.
But you guys feeling good? I mean, very successful again.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm feeling good. It's sometimes overwhelming as you get closer to the week. And, you know, this time for the first time, VIP, Ultimate VIP, all sold out.
Okay.
Connoisseurs, we were pretty close to selling out all of those tickets.
Our seminars were full this year.
Wow, absolutely,
And we joked around because we were talking about our first year where our seminars were so empty. We were sending like our mothers. We're like going, "Mom, go to that seminar. There's only two people there. We don't want them to see that." Mm-hmm. And now they're full. And so to us, it's really exciting because we just love bourbon and we love bourbon people. And so to see everyone here, they've become our friends. I mean, it's just amazing.
That's very cool.
Yeah, that what she was talking about, I was talking to Linda Ruffinack from the Whiskey Chicks earlier mm-hmm. today because mm-hmm. We were setting her room for her seminar, and it was 100% packed, not an empty seat. And I said, "You remember year one?" She goes, "When you sent your mom and Barbara's mom and your sisters, and none of them drink bourbon. They do now because they walked out of there staggering because they never drink." And
okay.
they had to drink what they were doing because they had to make cocktails and stuff. So it was quite funny watching them come out of there. But that's what Linda was saying, that, you know, big difference from year one to year three, everything being sold out in full.
Absolutely. That's great. Mm-hmm. And it's still comfortable, though. I want to emphasize that point because we know how the challenges, I'll say, of certain festivals that go on in this town and anywhere is just kind of striking that balance. And you guys have been very good at that every year, of striking this very good balance of it's accessible, it's fun, it's informative. I love the seminar portion of this because I think that's such an important, you know, the grand tastings are great, don't get me wrong, but I mean, the seminar portions and interacting with, so you guys get great people that come from the industry down here, and it's just really well done.
When we started the planning all this, Barbara and I basically said, and I think this is your phrase, we wanted to create something that we would go to, whether we're in Kentucky or Tennessee doing a whiskey festival or D.C., New York, we wanted to be exactly what we would want to go to as a consumer.
Mm-hmm.
You can bring all the industry experts in as the judges for our awards. We don't. We want the consumers to, they're the ones out there buying it, so we want them to make the choice of what they're drinking. And it's all blind.
And I honestly believe that the distilleries and the bourbon industry appreciates that because, you know, we don't want the big names up there. What we want is we want the guy that sits around the corner and is going to go spend $500 on a bottle, if that's what he really wants to do, mm-hmm. we want him to tell you what he thinks tastes good and what he likes.
Look, this is, and I thank you for saying that, Barbara, because part of the theme of some of the interviews that we've done here today, so we've had Peggy No Stevens on and Carla Carlton, and then actually after this, Susan Riegler will be on with us. And one of the universal themes is that this isn't about snobbery. This is about enjoyment. And you're supposed to enjoy it the way you want to enjoy it, right? And you're supposed to get from it what you want to get from it. And I'm a firm believer in this idea that there's a path to walk. So maybe something that you don't like now, maybe you will come to like, and that takes steps to get there, perhaps.
Yeah, of course.
But if it's not floating your boat, it's not floating your boat. And this isn't about, you know, only I can have this bottle. That's not what, I mean, to me, that's not what this is about.
I said earlier on Thursday I did an interview, and they're asking about what's my favorite bourbon. You know, for me, that's a hard
question. That's a tough question.
We have 850 bottles of bourbon in our home on our bar.
Please don't come to our home and take our bourbon.
I thought you were going to say, please come to our home and help us drink it.
But I was asked, you know, about the levels of bourbon. And I'm like, you know, the thing is, some of the really great tasting bourbons are on the bottom shelf. And people don't want to bend down and grab an $8, $10 bottle. They don't think it's good.
Right.
But, you know, some of them are really great. So, you know, reach for those bottles. You don't always have to go to the top shelf. You know, everybody's trying to get the most sought-after unicorn bourbon in the world. And you know what? They're just really hard to get. They call them unicorns for a reason.
Right.
They just don't exist everywhere.
Mm-hmm. But the problem is there's a taste and a flavor profile for everyone at every level.
Yep.
So, I mean, you can find great $10, $12 bourbons. I mean, there's 20s, there's 50s, it just doesn't matter. Don't be caught up in what everyone tells you you should want to taste.
Right, absolutely. And I couldn't agree more. And I think, you know, coming from the world of wine, which I do first before spirits and other things, I always use the term dollar to performance ratio. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of things you pay a lot of money for that I could probably show you four other things that are a fraction of the price that are at least 90% as good, if not better. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, well, look, more power to you. It's a perceived value, right?
Right.
I think a lot of this. But when we get down to the juice, it's whether you like the juice or you don't like the juice.
Exactly. Yeah.
Well, you know, I'm a numbers girl because I am a CPA and a CFO. And I will tell you, numbers don't lie and value is value.
Value is value, right? Yeah, there you go. So, well, let's do this because we were kind of hinting around this there, and people are hearing this about a week and a half or so after the festival is over. So this won't be breaking news then, but it's breaking news now. So the four of us sitting in the room, we have breaking news.
We do have breaking news. And Barbara runs an amazing bourbon awards program for us, which is a blind tasting. Our ultimate VIP judges, guest, we only sell 40 of those tickets. It costs them about $500 to buy that ticket. And they get a lot of special stuff. They got to go to a private Sazerac party last night.
Yeah.
They get to come in an hour early to the venue.
Don't forget the private select.
Earlier today with Denny Potter, the master distiller for Maker's Mark, and Frank, who runs the territory for the Maker's Mark private select program. Our judges, which they didn't know until about a week or so ago, were the 40 of them sat in the room with those guys and picked the 2020 New Orleans Bourbon Festival Maker's Mark Private Select Barrel.
That's cool.
And it'll be out somewhere as around August of this year for next year's festival.
Yes. Okay. Oh, okay, great.
Yeah. But anyway, you were telling what they do.
With the awards.
I'm just keeping you.
Yeah. So it's
that's my job, if y'all don't know
It's a blind tasting, and we flight it. So, you know, we're going through the flights. We end up with, what are we judging, about 70 different bourbons?
It was 75.
75.
It isn't 75 different bourbons, but it's 75 different entries.
Entries.
Okay.
Some enter in multiple categories. And, you know, Barbara runs this. We have a tasting board that gets the Capita glasses from Glencairn. All the whiskey's put in a little sample bottle. And they, you know, based on the number on the bottle, corresponds with their SurveyMonkey. We use SurveyMonkey on
okay,
the program.
Okay, sure. There you go.
Barbara's got it all set up, and everybody downloads it, so it's all done electronically. And we go through the process, and they make their selections. And
they judge on five things. They judge on color, and taste, and nose, and finish, and then overall drinkability.
Okay.
And it rates it one as poor and five as outstanding.
Great.
And so, you know, when you put it in, numbers don't lie. And so when you download the numbers and you multiply it all out, the winner, right?
Yeah, there you go.
So this year we had a surprising winner.
I'm going to go ahead and get a little poor.
You normally, we're going to tell listeners out there, because Tracy normally doesn't have any nips until the grand tastings in the evenings. But we are talking about... thank you, Barbara. I do. And me too. So,
okay. Well, good for us.
Yeah, I feel better now, Tracy, that you've joined us here. You didn't make me feel bad at all. Almost by happenstance, this was the bottle that you brought in that when I was taping earlier to try, and you've been very gracious that way. But...
At that time, you did not know. I had no idea that
only
this
I
bourbon
knew.
Oh, you're right.
Would okay. do what it did. And I'm not going to spoil it and say it. because Barbara runs that show. And
no,
it's,
I want you to do
you
it.
You want me to? All right.
I do. You're the so face. So,
I brought a bottle of Cooper's Craft, new barrel. What is this one? The new Barrel Reserve, just recently released in the market. We actually did a press event for them yesterday.
Oh, yeah. That's right.
And
that was
what
very
they're
nice
going to find out when we do the awards second line through the venue is that Cooper's Craft Barrel Select Barrel Reserve won Best in Fest.
Wow. Yeah, so, that's fantastic.
Of all the bourbons in that category, that entries.
And, guys,
this
there
the
were
one.
Some pretty high-end bourbons in this entry. Mm-hmm. So,
and this is about a $35 retail,
yeah,
$40 retail
exactly.
bottle?
$35 or $40
maybe. Yeah, right. Yeah.
Exactly.
And this one, Best in Fest. Our judges picked this one.
That's fantastic.
And I think they're going to be surprised, but congratulations to Cooper's. I mean, seriously.
Absolutely.
You know, this is the kind of thing you want to know. I mean, when you have a blind tasting and they don't know what they're tasting, I mean...
Yeah, it's amazing what people pick when you remove that part of the perception of it, right?
Exactly.
Well, and the thing is, I got to taste this a couple of weeks ago before it actually hit the shelves.
Okay.
It's good. It really is a good bourbon.
I think it's very good.
It's at 100 actually. Proof, and it's yeah. really it's
it,
good.
It has a nice finish, but it doesn't burn. It mm-hmm. has amazing flavor. It's got a lot of bright fruit. I mean, it has everything that you might want in a bourbon, but... It's very drinkable,
and
I think ultimately
balanced.
That's what really matters.
Absolutely. Now, I should probably clarify for listeners, if you're picking up a little background noise here, it's not the peanut gallery that's actually cheering for Cooper's Craft.
No, they are.
So, is that what's going on?
I
okay.
think that's what's happening.
Or is it the SEC gymnastics championships are actually happening at the
same time? Or both.
Or both, yeah.
A funny coincidence here, before we came in here, that is the Kentucky UK gymnastics team that they're cheering for out there.
Oh, that is okay.
So we're sitting here drinking Kentucky bourbon.
Yeah.
And the UK fans are out there cheering the gymnastics as they go to the hotel to go to the event tonight.
But is it okay if I say go Tigers?
You can say go Tigers.
Okay. Go Tigers.
Yeah. Through, yeah, I think it'll be loud when they come through.
Yeah. And that's good. And for clarity's sake, we are not giving the athletes any bourbon right now.
No.
Not at all.
We
have made sure doors are locked. Bourbon is picked up because we're like, there's young people around here. We better pick up our bourbon.
Exactly. Now, I'm sure some of the parents might need it by now.
they may have been sneaking in and getting some too. I don't know. So.
Well, y'all, let me ask you this question too before we close out this portion of the segment here with you. So great third year, and I don't want to put the cart before the horse, but anything that we're thinking about year number four? How are we feeling about, I mean, because I like the venues where you guys have it now. I think it's nice doing the grand tastings at the Contemporary Arts Center. It's a good space, and the Hilton Riverside's proven to be a very nice host for the seminar stuff and things like that. Anything? I mean, and if not, if it's like, man, we're just going to keep doing this right, then I'm all good with that.
But let me tell you one thing we are doing. We're going to ask for feedback from the people that have attended, our ultimate VIPs, our vendors. So what we do is we strive for continuous improvement. I know that sounds kind of passe, but,
no, not at all.
You know, truly what we want, we take our constructive feedback and we work really hard to make those changes. So we're going to hear what everyone has to say, and we're going to adjust those things that we need to, but we're not looking at increasing the number of people by a huge amount.
Okay, great.
We really don't want to change a lot of those things, but we continue to want to give the people that attend the best experience they can possibly have. So whatever that's going to be, it's going to happen.
Awesome. That's great. And I appreciate that. And I'm not just blowing smoke when I say I think you guys do a great job, and I really enjoy the festival, and congratulations on another really good year.
Did you have anything to add to that? I didn't mean to take your thunder, but
I want to give props to our other partner, David Freitas,
who
manages the space. So when we get the layouts for the hotel, we together work on the ticketing piece. We don't put more tickets in the system than the hotel will hold or the venue will hold. Mm-hmm. You know, we can get about 1,500 people in the CAC with all the booths in the parking lot. We don't want any more than that in there. So that's our max number there. We have X number of rooms. They hold, some hold 50, some hold 100, some hold 250. Mm-hmm. And we stay in those parameters. When people ask, hey, can I squeeze in? I know it's sold out. We politely say no.
We're
because
sorry.
we don't want it to get packed and overfilled. We want people to have a comfortable time. So we try to stay within the rules that they give us for room size and venue size.
I think it works great. And I think one of my favorite parts about it is when we go to the grand tastings, there's time to actually interact with the people. And in many cases, it's the distiller, you know, somebody with the brand that's there that knows what they're talking about, and they're sharing their product and they're sharing their passion. And I find that, you know, I don't feel like I'm being rushed away, you know, and I'm not, there's not 50 people standing behind me waiting to get a pour, because I don't want to be that guy and just blocking the table to, you know, have my own conversation with the person. There's time to interact with people, which and then I'm able to learn, which is why I'm doing this. I'm not just here to pound bourbon. I'm here to learn stuff.
Yeah.
And I think you guys provide that.
And that's what we want. We built this event for the consumer. You know, the industry events are great, and we've attended them. We love them. But this is for the consumer. And that's – while we do have a lot of industry people here, we want the people – what she calls me, a bourbon nerd.
Did y'all not see my T-shirt, hashtag bourbon nerd?
I saw it. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
There's a lot of guys like me and women like me. I mean, this is what –
women
are bourbon nerds.
Okay. Sorry.
You probably should.
And women are becoming a huge part of this industry. I mean, we're looking at over 40% of the bourbon drinking world are female.
Well, you do know. Right. I mean, we did a bourbon women event this year.
Absolutely.
And it has been fantastic. Look, Peggy knows Stevens and that group are awesome.
They were great. And probably listeners have heard, depending on what order they're listening to things, have heard that interview with Peggy and Carla, and just great.
Aren't they awesome? Fantastic. Ladies?
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
We love them. Yeah.
Yeah. Awesome. Yeah, so you guys, before we got to close this out, but tell people, Tracy, where they can find out more information online about New Orleans Bourbon Fest, and then be on the lookout for year four and all that good stuff.
Yeah, it's www.nobourbonfest.com, or they can follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. It's NO Bourbon Fest. And we can tell you when it's going to happen next year.
If you already know, then please.
Mention our charity, which is
kidscandola.org.
Because, you know, this is actually about that, is we are trying to raise money for our charity, which is focused on children, any children's charity. But this year, our beneficiary is St. Michael's Special School.
Okay, great.
We're trying to create a tuition assistance program for them.
To help families pay their tuition.
Yeah, that's great.
Thank you so much.
Because St. Michael's Special School is a great organization.
We want to be able to just help different children's charities, as whether it's health, education, or any medical needs. You know,
welfare. Yeah, exactly.
But we have, based on what's going on in the city, we work with the convention bureau, the hotels. We know we want to stay in this third weekend if we can, but we know next year there's a gigantic medical convention coming this weekend next year.
Okay.
So we have decided, we've already signed the deal with the hotel, and we will be the 11th through the 15th.
Of March.
March.
Okay.
So we'll be right before St. Patrick's Day.
That works.
So we may have some St. Paddy's Day parading going on that weekend.
Well, that'll be fun. And it's about
the Irish to come over and drink some of our American whiskey.
Maybe we'll use green umbrellas next year for our second line.
There you go. There you go. Okay. Perfect. And you know, and it'll be nicely about 3 weeks removed from Mardi Gras. So we'll have that. We'll have had that nice break.
Yes. I'm waiting for Mardi Gras back to the beginning of February.
Right.
I'd like a month between the festival and Mardi Gras. We had 2.5 weeks this year. I think we're going to get about 2.5 weeks next year.
Yeah, okay.
And with us riding, and I ride in Endymion, I think we're going to try to ride Orpheus next year as well. That takes up a lot of time, too, in the middle of all the planning and the getting set for this.
Yeah. It's hard.
And remember, I work for a seafood company. This is kind of a busy time.
Lent would be busy for you, wouldn't it?
I just want to point that out.
Barbara, too, tell people where they can, because you do a fantastic bourbon podcast. Tell people where they can find it.
I do. You can find me with the Bourbon Betties on the ABV Network. I'm usually not the appropriate one. And I'm also Nola Bourbon's wife on Instagram.
I didn't know that was your handle. Okay.
You know, I get tired of, you're Tracy's wife. I'm like, no, he's my husband. Uh-huh, uh-huh. So I actually set up my Instagram account to be at Nola Bourbon's wife.
That's great. You too, thank you so much, and congratulations on another great festival.
Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Friends, we're going to take a brief break. We'll be back with Susan Riegler. Come on back. All right, everybody, welcome back. Yeah, it's our extended bonus coverage here of the third annual New Orleans Bourbon Fest on the NOLA Drink Show. Thanks, everybody, for joining us today. And, yeah, we're here at the Hilton Riverside Hotel, as you know, and pleased to be joined by my guest, Susan Riegler. Susan, how are you?
I am terrific. I have been drinking bourbon for all weekend.
Yeah, which is great.
Which is pretty much what everybody's been doing. That's the whole point, isn't it?
It is the whole point, exactly. Yeah. It's something we're all sharing in common here. It's a
Indeed.
Shared experience.
It is.
Well, that's great. And you and I actually met very, very briefly a couple of years ago, and I had Peggy No Stevens and Carla Carlton on with me yesterday.
Oh, very good.
And you were on a panel with them the first go-round of
Correct.
Bourbon Fest, and it was a bourbon women panel, and I think it was a debunking the myths maybe or something along those lines. It was a guided
something
tasting.
Something like that, right. A guiding tasting, and we did a little survey to see which of the bourbons that participants liked the best. And as happens almost invariably in our tasting panels, we find that the women, the members of the Bourbon Women's Association, maybe they're just a self-selecting group, but our membership absolutely gravitates to the high-proof, complex, really heavy-hitter bourbons.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I'm trying to recall. We don't need to bog down in this. There was sort of a big reveal at the end, and I think there was one where everybody was really surprised by what it was, and I can't remember what we tasted. Do you recall?
I do not remember that, but... Okay.
You know what? We'll ask Peggy after. Maybe she'll remember.
Yeah,
and then
she might remember. But I mean, it might have been. It wasn't Booker's, but it was something that was in that range.
Yes,
you know,
and people were really excited about it. And people thought that it wasn't what it was. Everybody was almost surprised by it.
Right.
So I'm building this whole mystery, and we'll have no answer. But that's all right.
That's okay.
I'll put it on the Facebook page or something like that. But Susan, so you are an author and an educator in the mm-hmm. world of whiskey. And can you tell us a little bit about your background? How did you find your way there?
Well, it did not hurt to be born in Louisville, Kentucky.
Okay, there you go.
Yeah, that was a good start. Thank you, parents. Yeah, that was good.
Right on.
And the second part of that, in my professional background, even though my academic background is in zoology and in music, I was a journalist. I'm still a journalist, I suppose, because I write for several whiskey publications, but I was the restaurant critic and beverage writer for the Louisville Courier Journal for 15 years, starting in 1992. And that was just about the time that bourbon was just barely beginning to make its comeback. So I was the first reporter to write about this distillery in Versailles, Kentucky, that was called LeBrow and Graham when it opened, and eventually is, of course, now called Woodford Reserve.
Right.
I got to interview Booker No at his kitchen table and drink Booker's with him one morning. I emphasize this was morning. That was a good time. And he was just such a wonderful character, a really sweet man. And that was special. And so I did that. I just got to interview a lot of people in the whiskey industry before virtually any other reporter was paying any attention. And that was something that has led to what I'm doing now.
What, was it something just because of by proximity and then the paper became interested in
well,
it because the industry
you
was
know,
so
part
important
of this,
there?
And I kind of made more work for myself, but it was good work. There was an article in the Washington Post about this renamed distillery in Frankfort, Kentucky that was introducing a new bourbon. It was called Buffalo Trace. And I went into my editor and I said, you know, why is the Washington Post writing about this and the Louisville Courier Journal is not? This would be like leaving the Kentucky Derby to the Chicago Tribune.
Yeah, right,
what
right.
are we doing here? And he said, okay, you now have a beverage column. I said, oh, good. Okay, another deadline
Thanks.
This week. But it was fine because it led me eventually after I left the paper, since I had to find a drink of the week. And by the way, I called it Drink, the Sipping News. I'm very proud of that.
Very nice. Very well done.
Yeah. Yes. And because of that, I discovered the bourbon cocktails of Joy Perini. And Joy, who was fabulous mixologist. In fact, she's one of only two bartenders in the Kentucky Bourbon Hall of Fame, the other being Dale DeGroff.
Oh, Dale is. Okay, I didn't know
that.
Yeah, uh-huh.
And because of what she did with bourbon and turning it into the bourbon cocktail scene, and she started that early on before anyone else was doing it. So when I left the Courier and it wouldn't be a conflict of interest, I said to Joy, you know, you have some fabulous bourbon recipes. I would have featured one of her drinks every week if I've gotten away with it, you know. And I said, you should have a book of recipes. And she said, well, yeah. She was from New Jersey. Yeah, I know. But, you know, I'm not really a writer. I don't have time. You know, I'm kind of working. And I said, well,
right.
Joy, you give me your recipes and I'll turn them into a book. And that's how the Kentucky Bourbon Cocktail Book came about.
Okay.
Really the first specialized bourbon cocktail, which is now in its sixth printing.
Oh, wow. Congratulations.
Yeah, thank you. And that was kind of the beginning of, it wasn't the beginning of my writing bourbon books because I'd done a bourbon country travel guide, but that has really taken off and people started paying much more attention, I think, to the idea of bourbon cocktails and not, you know, beyond the classics,
right,
of course, but
right,
being very creative with bourbon. And
so about what year was that?
That
Susan?
Was just about 10 years ago now.
Okay, okay.
Yeah. Yeah, I'd have to go back and look at that, but it was about 10, I think 2009 was when that was published. That's exactly right, so
okay,
10 years ago,
yeah.
Yeah. So that was kind of the beginning, and as I kept talking to people in the industry and coming up with books, and one of the people I had interviewed for The Courier was Michael Veach, so mm-hmm. I got to know Mike,
mm-hmm.
and then we together authored the Bourbon Tasting Notebook. It's been fascinating. The wonderful thing about the bourbon industry and in my travel guide and going around and writing about bourbon and how to visit bourbon country was seeing how truly proud everyone in the industry is of what they do and just how enthusiastic and passionate they are about it, how the people in the industry, you know, they're kind of friendly competitors, you know, they are competitors. But, for instance, when Heaven Hill's distillery burned down and Brown-Forman and Beam and Barton all pitched in to help Heaven Hill make their mm-hmm. whiskeys,
mm-hmm.
you know, General Motors was not going to help Ford if Ford had a plant
burned down. Right,
yeah.
Exactly.
That's a whole different kind of business community. And I think that just speaks to the heritage of bourbon in Kentucky and how people are always willing to help their neighbors.
I think that's great. And I think that we, Peggy and Carla and I were talking yesterday. I think it was off the air. But, you know, we're talking about all the familial connections that go on there as well.
Oh, yes.
And I mentioned to them jokingly, this was off air, I'm pretty sure, that I said, because I'm a fan, but I'm not at the nerd level. Right,
okay.
If that makes sense. And so
it
kind of reminds me of like the Game of Thrones family tree. I can't quite keep everybody straight and who everybody is.
Just try to sort out the beams. That's
a
game in itself. Yeah.
Exactly. So that,
that's not a tree, that's a forest.
That's a forest. There you go.
Yeah.
So, and the Bourbon Tasting Notebooks, it's a great publication. I actually got that from you directly a couple of years ago at Bourbon Fest.
Thank you.
And
do you have the new edition? This is the second edition.
Okay, then I don't think so.
This has 50% more bourbons in it.
50% more bourbons.
This tells you about what's happening in the industry.
Okay.
The first edition had 215 bourbons. This one has 340.
Oh, wow. Goodness.
Yeah, exactly.
Wow. So
and we just keep tasting.
Yeah,
is this a terrible job?
It's a horrible job. And I'm guessing people send you the bottles, right?
A lot of them do, yes.
Yeah, okay.
And otherwise, we have some collections of whiskey, Mike and I, between us. And then we might go to great places like Bourbon's Bistro, and we'll order some glasses and split them. And,
okay.
Yeah.
Now, did you guys generally work collaboratively on this? Like, we're tasting together?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Yeah, what we do, which is, I think, sort of interesting, is we have some tasting sheets,
mm-hmm.
and we'll taste four or five or six, never more than six at a time.
Makes sense.
And we each make our notes, and then at the very end, we read them to each other. And that way, we are not influencing each other on what we're doing. Otherwise, it means every once in a while, one of us will say, but
right.
We try not to give too much away, because the important part about the book, we don't rate the bourbons.
Right.
We leave that to the reader, because mm-hmm. everybody's palate is different.
Mm-hmm.
And we might, you know, Mike might like something I don't, or I like something he doesn't, or generally we're pretty much in agreement if we think it's a good bourbon, but if I taste cinnamon, if I detect cinnamon on the nose, he might not get it until the palate,
mm-hmm.
or if he gets cherries on the nose, I might not get it till the finish, and mm-hmm. so it just is mm-hmm. that. How people's palates are different.
Absolutely. You know, and I thank you for saying that, because you guys point that out at the beginning of the book, I recall correctly, saying that, you know, let's kind of frame this in a way that is, you know, this is about enjoyment.
Correct.
And this is about you getting from it what you the reader, the taster,
exactly.
need to get from it. And that's so important. I think in anything we get into this world, I actually asked Peggy and Carla this conversation, because we have moved into a phase. I worked in the wine industry, Susan, for a long time.
Oh, okay.
And so it reminds me of this to a degree, where, you know, we've kind of hit
certain pockets of snobbery and some things that have popped up.
Right.
And the I know more than you thing. Mm. And especially the online forums and some of those things where, you know,
right,
people are just looking for information and they're looking for guidance, and then somebody will kind of attack them.
Oh, that's the worst.
And that's the worst. And that's not, in my view, this is about enjoyment and,
right,
and fun discussion.
Exactly. And if you tell me that you are tasting, you know, old boots in your whiskey, fine. Who am I to say you're not tasting that? Because that's your sensory evaluation.
We're all wired.
Enjoy your,
right,
old boots, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Now, the marketing people get a hold of that, and they'll call it something else.
They will.
This is like where we get these notes of, you know, something that's very sort of like a musty and
earthy,
grassy
leather.
Yeah, a forest floor is always one of my favorites.
Oh, that's a good one. No. One that I really like that I actually think is very legitimate is Barnyard.
Barnyard, yeah.
Yeah, which the wine people use that too.
Barnyard, very much.
But that pops up, and that's very legitimate, and that's kind of the polite way of saying hay and manure.
And manure.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like what I would write tasting notes is not to get too far off track. So I did a lot of wine reviews and tasting note writing,
uh-huh,
and
uh-huh,
I would write the notes in the actual way. So I would write manure.
Okay.
And then I would go, then if I'm writing this for like a client, then manure is going to become barnyard. It's going to become earthy.
Exactly.
It's going to become hay.
Exactly.
You know, it has this sort of manure note, but in a good way.
Exactly. Yeah, you have to be kind of careful in that. This is not bad.
No, this is not bad. So let's talk about some of the other publications. I think you have another a companion to this coming out, right?
Yes. Yes. We're tentatively calling it Beyond Bourbon, Tasting Notes for the Other American Whiskies. So that will include rye, Tennessee, malts, blends, kind of the odd grains, things like quinoa, oats, buckwheat. Tasted a really interesting buckwheat whiskey last week.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Who's producing that?
I can't remember offhand. You know, when you taste six a day,
until
I've typed up those notes, I have to type them back out so they get in the brain. But
this is starting to remind me this is going to be a Whole Foods barrel selection, the quinoa.
Oh, yeah, exactly. That's the power food whiskey. Yeah.
Right. So do you guys have a publication date in mind?
We think if we get it all wrapped, we've been told if we wrap it up to get as many whiskeys as we want to have in it, have it into the publisher by mid-July, I believe, then it should come out in October.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah, so we definitely bring it here next year to New Orleans, okay, to the Bourbon Festival.
Wonderful. Okay,
yeah.
Great.
Yeah.
Well, you know, Tracy Napolitano, who organizes Bourbon Fest, was kind enough to, he keeps bringing me, every time I tape here, he brings me a bottle of something really
good for Tracy,
which I really like. And so we're drinking the Cooper's Craft, their Kentucky Straight 100 Proof.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think about it, Sue?
Well, you know, I have liked it. I don't think I've ever tasted a Brown-Forman product I haven't liked. Mm-hmm. They've been making whiskey since 1870, so they kind of know what they're doing.
Right.
Even through Prohibition, they were making whiskey. And, of course, what they did with this particular brand is that they're honoring their coopers, the people making the barrels, because Brown-Forman is the only distillery in the world that owns its own cooperage.
Yeah.
In fact, they own two because the explosion in American whiskey, they had been making all their barrels in Louisville, including for Jack Daniel's, which, of course, is their biggest selling product. Mm-hmm. And then they had so much demand for all their bourbons that they had to build a whole new cooperage in Huntsville, Alabama, just to supply Lynchburg.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So they are very committed to barrels. And they do something a little different. They're honoring this idea of the role that the barrel has in bourbon. They have a special design in the Cooper's Craft barrels where they kind of score the staves so they're kind of like Ruffles potato chips with ridges, mm-hmm, or a little extra.
I saw a sample of that yesterday, actually.
Yeah. So a little more absorptive surface, mm-hmm, in that. And I think, and they use a different mash bill and yeast strain than they use for Woodford and for Old Forester.
Okay.
So
sure,
they've come out with a distinct product with, mm-hmm, the Cooper's Craft.
I thought it was interesting. I was mentioning to you before we started recording that we tasted their 82 yesterday,
mm-hmm,
and then we tasted their 86, and you were telling me the 86 was the original, basically the original Old Forester.
Well, or the one that they've been...
The main one.
Been selling for decades, yeah.
Right. I didn't know that.
Mm-hmm.
And it was interesting because they were kind of, and not to go too far off script here either, but they were talking about, not that the show has a script, let me be clear about that.
no, I see nothing in writing in front of me.
Yeah.
I agree.
We did pre-production. It was, hey, how you doing? You want to sit down?
Yeah, exactly. And then, oh, okay, sure, sure, I can do this.
We can do this. They were talking about this sort of 82 being an entry level, and to me it like, yeah, seemed like it worked great in a high ball. And then the 86, I think, is where they were using the different, as you said, the different barrels. It was a little more intense.
Right, obviously. Right. And then the 100 proof, I think, is very interesting.
I like this a lot. Mm-hmm. I find it very enjoyable, and it's well balanced. And
uh-huh. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
A lot of fruit. Mm-hmm. A lot of fruit, a lot of spice.
Very dried fruit kind
going
on in it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and one of the things I want to mention about the Bourbon Tasting Notebook mm-hmm. is that it's indexed by proof and price and style, as well as alphabetically. So if you're tasting an 86-proof bourbon and you want to compare it to other 86-proof bourbons, you just look in the index and you can see how many of them are 86-proof.
Yeah.
Which makes kind of an interesting flight. You know, you could pick a proof and say, yeah, I want to do that. Or wheated bourbons, and you can look in the index and say, who's a wheater? And try that out. So that was our goal in putting together a book like this, was to make it very user-friendly, give people a lot of information in one place that maybe they didn't have in one place.
Mm-hmm. I love that idea, because I think when people taste, and doing a lot of wine and some spirits education and stuff like that, I always tell people, you know, we tend to, just in day-to-day life, I use the term, we drink monolithically, meaning that we, you know, we're having a thing.
Right.
And the best way to improve your palate is to taste things side by side and kind of create a contrasting framework. And then the idea also to, you know, I'm a big fan of, maybe you change one variable or two variables. So say in the world of wine, or even in the world of bourbon, as we're talking about here, or whiskey, you know, taste different expressions from the same producer.
Oh, yes.
You know, or as you
absolutely.
Said, or do a horizontal tasting by proof, or things like that. And I think that's a really great way for people to improve their palates and to actually learn how to describe things. Because I think we're always, I'm sure you get a lot of this, that learning the words, the vernacular to use to actually describe, it's a tough step for people to learn sometimes.
It is. And, of course, I realized this when I was hired as the restaurant critic at the Courier. I couldn't just say, that was a good dinner.
Right.
That tasty. Really didn't tell anybody anything. So you have to use adjectives. And the other thing about this, you know, it's fruity or it's nasty or whatever it is that you want to say. And what you do, you develop that vocabulary, but you've also developed a taste memory. Right. So if you pick up a glass of whiskey, and you go, oh, I know what that flavor is, but I can't name it.
Yep.
Well, the way you do that is by practicing. And actually, after I got over the excitement of being hired as a full-time restaurant critic at a major newspaper, I thought, well, what if I am eating out and I say, oh, I really enjoy this sauce and that lovely tarragon note, and it's really rosemary. Boy, am I going to look like a goat, right? So I suddenly panicked, and I went to my spice cabinet, and I got out all little bottles of spices, and I started practicing blind sniffings, you know, blind nosings of different, you know, different herbs, different spices, so I could say, okay, I know with confidence that's what
that's that flavor. Note.
And anybody can do that. It's just a matter of taking the time and then saying, all right, I'm going to put that into my taste memory and vocabulary.
Absolutely. You know, and I think, I don't know how you recommend people do this, Susan. One of the things I will tell people is, you know, pull up a list of, say you're drinking a Cabernet. Just we'll pick a wine, for example.
Right.
You're drinking a Cabernet, and just pull up common tasting notes of Cabernet, even though it has nothing to do with the one that you're tasting specifically.
Right.
Because there will be some overlap in that list. Mm-hmm. And very much as you just said, people being able to articulate that smell, there is that click that you need to see. That's, blackberry, there it is.
Yeah, right.
And then you go, I get it. And once you've done that a few times, then it becomes very easy, as you're saying,
easier, absolutely.
To pick these things out. And I think just these little things that we can all do when we appreciate whiskey or we appreciate wine or food or anything like that is pulling back and stopping to kind of think about it, pay attention,
exactly,
describe it, articulate something, have conversation with your friends or your peers.
That's exactly right. And when I do bourbon tastings for people, I give them multiple choice. I say, all right, there's a fruit note in here. What do you think it is? Is it banana or cherry or peach or orange or cherry? And if you give them some options, then they say, oh, yeah, I knew what that was, but I couldn't articulate it. Rather than saying, you are tasting orange peel here, I don't want to tell them that. I want to say, here's your choice, or to make it too open, like, what are you tasting? And then they panic and they say, you know, what do I know?
Right. Yeah, right.
So give them some multiple choice.
That's a great idea.
And that gets them over that kind of fear.
Yeah, I think that's
fear factor.
That's a great idea. Once you have the words, it becomes less fearful, doesn't it?
It does.
Well, I'm going to ask you...
Or name your fear.
Name your fear. Right, there you go. Let me ask you, and I'm sort of joking here, a controversial question, since you've been writing, and your colleague Michael Veach there, also a very fine author and educator in and of himself, great storyteller as well.
Absolutely. A walking encyclopedia of whiskey history.
Indeed.
Incredible.
His theory, since we are sitting here in New Orleans, his theory about how bourbon gets its name.
Oh, yes.
And Michael advocates the story that it comes from Bourbon Street in New Orleans as opposed to Bourbon County in Kentucky.
Mm.
Where do you come down on that? And if you want to take the fifth, feel free to take the fifth.
Right. Well, that is a tough one.
Mm-hmm.
Though I do think that connection between shipping whiskey from Kentucky downriver to New Orleans and, of course, having, you know, it may or may not have had Bourbon County stamped on the barrel.
Mm-hmm.
There certainly was a Bourbon Street. Of course, we had the, Kentuckians, grateful Americans, and especially Kentuckians naming counties and cities and all of that after the French royalty. I mean, after mm-hmm. all, we truly are drinking bourbon. We don't say that.
Right,
but
right.
Bourbon got its name from the French royal family.
Right, yep.
Have I rambled enough to avoid the question?
You've done a fine job. And actually, that part is true. It takes its name from the royal family, whether by way of the street or by way of
right.
the region.
But I do think that because it was aged, it was the closest thing they could get to cognac.
I think there's a sensibility there.
That red whiskey from Kentucky, and somehow or other, it started being called bourbon.
Bourbon. I think that, there you go. Well answered, Susan. That was really well done. Well, before we close things out here on this segment, can you tell people where they can find you online, find the books and all that good stuff.
Right. Well, you can contact me directly at susanrigler@gmail.com. It's all one word, SusanReigler, at gmail.com. Or you can just go to susanrigler.com. I have a webpage. And to buy the books, you can go to your best-known international monolithic online book company. we'll have it. Yeah, as it has all of my books, and I'm glad for that. They're out and about. A lot of the national booksellers have it online. Indie.com as well.
And, oh, okay, great.
Yeah, or you can just put my name in or put in Bourbon Tasting Notebook, and it'll pop up
and track
you can
it
get
way.
It. Yeah.
Yeah, great. And
yeah.
And
the
also...
distilleries in Kentucky all carry it in their gift shops.
Oh, okay. And I was
so if you're
people...
visiting Kentucky, yeah.
Yeah, oh, fantastic. And I was also going to tell people just, come to the 4th annual Bourbon Fest
next year. Absolutely.
Get
I'll
a
be
signed
here.
Copy.
I will be signing, and Mike will probably sign one for you, too. He'll be here. And
yeah.
Yeah.
Excellent. Well, Susan, thank you so much for taking some
time
and chatting.
I appreciate the opportunity.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Great.
Friends, we're going to take a brief break. Come on back. All right, everybody, thanks for listening into the show this week. I really appreciate it, as always. As we noted, next week will be the last French Quarter Fest series show that we do before French Quarter Fest. We're going to keep doing that series, probably not quite at the breakneck pace that we have been doing it, but Paul Sanchez and John Boutte will be here talking about French Quarter Fest, their music, their collaboration, all kinds of really cool stuff. Two really cool, interesting, fun, great musician guys that we're going to have on. And then also, as I mentioned at the top of the show, we're going to have the show featuring vintage cocktail books, cocktail history. We're going to be talking with three luminaries in that field, Jeff Beachbum, Barry Greg Bohm, and Jim Meehan. Going to be some really interesting stuff in a couple weeks. Friends, welcome to The Parting Shot. Hey, we had a really long show today, so we're pretty much just going to say, hey, New Orleans Bourbon Fest, it was a great time, had a lot of great bourbon. Congratulations to Cooper's Craft for winning Best in Show. Very fine bourbon you can pick up for less than $40, I believe. So, hey, friends, go pour yourself a bourbon. That's our parting shot. Here's to you.